Andrew.
And I'm Spencer, and you're listening to the At a Distance podcast from The Slowdown. Today, we'll be speaking with Raj Patel, a research professor at the University of Texas at Austin's Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs, a professor in the university's Department of Nutrition, and a research associate at Rhodes University in South Africa. He is the co-author of the new book, Inflamed: Deep Medicine and the Anatomy of Injustice.
Raj is also the author of the books Stuffed and Starved and The Value of Nothing, and the co-author of A History of the World in Seven Cheap Things, the co-director of the documentary The Ants and the Grasshopper about climate change and the global food system. He serves on the International Panel of Experts on Sustainable Food Systems and has advised governments worldwide on sustainability.
Raj is exactly the kind of deep, multidisciplinary thinker we so appreciate, someone who is able to connect seemingly disparate things in a way that makes clear, cohesive sense. Let's get him on the line. Hi, Raj. Welcome to At a Distance. It's so great to have you with us today.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Spencer and Andrew.
So you have a new book out, and we're going to get to that shortly. But before we get into that, we just wanted to ask simply, what is on the top of your mind right now?
Agroecology. I'm working on a piece for the Scientific American, trying to explain to people who think that agriculture is just what happens in the field. What I'm struggling with is how to persuade people that what happens in the Ministry of Agriculture is also agriculture and also matters. And so I'm in sort of teacher mode at the moment, trying to be a good pedagogue, trying to figure out, you know, what prejudices people have and how to best unknit them. That's what's on my mind right now.
Mm. And your new book kind of connects to that. I mean, it focuses on inflammation, and this links, of course, to political, social, economic, ecological events. Why is it so often that we associate inflammation with diet and nutrition only and none of these other things?
Well, I mean, I guess it depends where you sit. I mean, the joy of working with a medical doctor who is my co-author, Rupa Maria, is that she sees inflammation from the other end. She works in a hospital and she sees people who are coming in with all kinds of inflammatory disease. In fact, most diseases that she sees are inflammatory, and from heart disease to diabetes to certain kinds of cancer. And all of these are sicknesses that she can find causes for, not just in our diet, though diet is absolutely a big part of it, but also in everything from exposure to the toxins of the 21st century to the stress of living under a racist and exploitative society. And all of these are exposures that generate inflammation in our bodies and prime our bodies so that when something like COVID comes along, it's going to be working people and people of color who are more likely to suffer the sort of long-term consequences of that rabid inflammation.
Based on the findings in the book and what you both wrote, could you speak to how inflammation connects to food, air, and microbes?
Here was the aha moment for me, where it's certainly the case that we have denuded our internal microbiome. So listeners might be familiar with the idea of the microbiome, right? That we are not just human beings, but an assembly of lots of different living things. And there are a range of stresses that denude our microbiomes. It's not just the fact that we live in a world where toxic chemistry has reduced the number of living things around us. I mean, a striking example, like when we were growing up and cycling along the street, we would routinely expect to get a face full of flies. We'd be picking flies out of our teeth at the end of the day. That doesn't happen anymore. When was the last time you were out for a bike ride and had to do that, right? Or for a long car journey and then had to clean the windshield like you used to when you were a kid. That's a sign that we are living in a world with a radically denuded biome in general. And that sort of toxic chemistry sits inside us as well as in the outside world. But for me, that chemistry is part of a bigger series of exploitations and dominations. And so here was the thing that really sort of caught my eye, because someone trained in economics as I am is aware that there are these very exploitative economic technologies like payday loans. A payday loan of $200, for example, would ultimately entail you're paying back nearer $500, right? So these payday loans are toxic financial products. And for a long time, I've understood that they are bad for working people and they're bad for society and they're great for Wall Street, but that's about it. Mm. But understanding that if we banned payday loans, the suicide rate would drop by 1.9% and the accidental drug overdose rate would drop by 8.9%. Wow. So huge reductions, public health reductions, helps me tell the story of how these constant stresses manifest in our bodies and render our bodies more open to despair, more open to not just sort of chronic depression, the sort of the most acute forms of despair that we know, right? Taking one's own life. And those kinds of stresses coming from outside our bodies are transmuted by the ways that complex ways that our bodies work normally to deal with stress into these life-ending forces through our microbiomes within our guts, through our skin, through our endocrine system, and through a range of bodily systems that we kind of lay out in the anatomy of injustice, as we call it in the book.
Mm. Right, and you go into these sort of instruments of oppression that prime our bodies for sickness. You mentioned payday loans. Why do you think, or is it connected to, that we're made to believe that these are issues of our own, that we need to solve these things on our own?
If we're thinking about how we are encouraged to treat our bodies, always we're suffering from an epidemic of victim blaming here. Whether it's the fact that we live in a fat-hating and fat-shaming society. And so, you know, even though there was a recent report that came out embarrassing to Nestle that 60% of their food is unhealthy, this is the world's largest food manufacturing company, 60% fails to meet a basic definition of healthy, right? And more than 98% of their non-coffee, non-water beverages are unhealthy. And in the United States, we spend $1.1 trillion a year on food, but the social and environmental costs of that are $2.3 trillion. So, you know, if you want a sustainable Snickers bar, you would have to buy 2.5 more Snickers bars to pay off the damage that this one Snickers bar causes. And, you know, the companies that have worked for 600 years to build a system where they don't have to pay the costs of, you know, the social costs of what they do, are very good at persuading us that the only way we can treat the diseases that are happening to us is through going out and exercising a bit more. You know, this is the standard line from the soda industry is that, you know, yes, soda is fun for you. And you know, what we can do is just encourage you to exercise a little bit more. Because really, you know, calories are fun. And we are the purveyors of fun. And you go enjoy yourself. Forget those killjoys who are telling you about the diabetes you'll develop. And so that idea of the individualized approach to medicine and to treating our bodies is part of the problem. Mm. It's not an accident, right, that we are facing social problems in an individualized way. And that really accounts for so much of the despair right now, where, you know, if we're thinking about social change, it's like, oh, God, now, you know, I have to worry about being woke about these five new things that I wasn't woke about before. So give me the label. I buy organic and I buy shade grown and I just want like woke friendly and that'll be fine. And all of a sudden you find yourself panicking at the supermarket and God knows, you know, it's hard enough shopping right now anyway. But again, that panic, that fear, that concern with not doing the right thing is manufactured.
And it extends outside of medicine, right? I mean, the climate crisis. You look at all of these areas where corporations are sort of set up to behave in this way and rewarded for this. So ultimately, even beyond health, this is really governmental regulation issue in terms of how they can communicate to us.
Well, but that's the problem, isn't it, Andrew? That instead of demanding, you know, tight restrictions on the plastics industry, instead we're throwing away our plastic straws, getting metal ones, and then never using them. And that's the response. As you say, it's an individualized rather than a social one. And so, you know, I think for us, the interesting question is, all right, well, how do we shift that mindset in a way that helps people realize it's not, you know, the duties of, you know, wokeness that we have to perform, but actually the act of liberation.
Mm. Yeah, and society. How do you define a society that functions for the people? Mm. Just one more question about that. Early on in the pandemic, I guess, you know, I don't remember exactly when, maybe April or May 2020, it was just becoming clear that the numbers were disproportionately, COVID was affecting people of color, at least in America. Were you already aware? Where were you in your book? Where were you in that process? Was this a surprise to you? How are you responding to these sort of reports that were coming out at the time and watching the divisiveness of the moment about the sort of narrative warfare against the individual and it being their fault?
You know, I mean, it was an odd time because we could see it coming. You know, we had been writing and following these ideas for a year or so in refining the proposal and refining the book. And so we were sort of neck deep in the writing of it at the time of the pandemic breaking out. And it was hard not to be cynical about the responses, right? Where you had communities of people of color developing symptoms of COVID and being exposed to it in ways that other diseases had also seen communities of people of color in the front line. So type 2 diabetes being one of them. But, you know, the response was, we're going to get out and bang some pots for the working class and for our frontline workers. And Rupa, who was, you know, on the COVID wards at the time, was like, I don't need a pot being banged. I need my nurses not to be in trash bags. But none of that seems to be happening. And, you know, it's emerged since then that some of these horrific conditions that healthcare workers were exposed to was not advised by anyone who was a medical doctor so much as it was pushed for by the Californian hospital industry lobbyists, who certainly in her neck of the woods were wielded an immense amount of power around the guidelines around who's exposed and who wasn't. But, you know, again, we see who's in the front lines of the worst paying professions in the United States. It's, you know, working class people of color disproportionately, but it's working class people in general who are out in the fields, who are delivering your groceries, who are, you know, working in warehouses. And their bodies have already been primed and inflamed through, you know, years of exposure to poverty. And now, you know, COVID comes along and it's lighting a very short fuse on a large bomb. Mm.
Back to the inflammation conversation, where does trauma come into this? And how do traumatic events from childhood or traumas endured by ancestors, how do those link to inflammation?
I mean, certainly we're aware of this sort of long and growing literature now on epigenetics of how certain traumas sustained not just one, but sometimes two generations ago can methylate certain DNA groups and present in generations later. So this is the sort of idea of seven generations, right? You know, we're living the consequences of three generations before us, and we're seeding the consequences for three generations after. Now, that idea is certainly one that we're well aware of, and certainly talking about intergenerational trauma and the trauma of adverse childhood events, for example, result in disparate outcomes in terms of everything from type 2 diabetes to heart disease to depression and suicidality and dementia. But it's important, and particularly this is a pushback from our comrades in other frontline communities, not to say just because, you know, particular communities have suffered trauma, therefore they are biologically destined to certain kinds of outcome, because the idea of biology as destiny has been weaponized so effectively in the past that it's still one of the things that, you know, folk in medical schools struggle with. Like, for example, historical ways of thinking about race in medicine results, for example, in 2016 in the United States with the view among white people that black people have thicker skin and are therefore, you know, less sensitive to pain. 58% of white people in America thought that in 2016. And 40% of first-year medical students thought that. And the problem is that by their fourth year, 20% of white medical students still thought that. So, you know, while it's true that trauma can be passed down through generations, and I mean, it does make an important and distinct difference in outcomes for communities exposed to the traumas of everything from policing to, you know, dispossession and violence that comes through having one's livelihood ripped away from them. It's also important to recognize that there are compounding factors that are much more mutable and actually need our attention right now that are contributing to that trauma and contributing and doing it every day. It's true that there is this sort of history of trauma, but it's also important not to believe that biology is destiny. For communities across the board, there are things that can and should be done because there's harm being done right now.
What did you learn about inflammation from looking at Indigenous communities and their practices?
The report just came out showing that Indigenous communities have teeming microbiomes. And because of this, they're much better able to manage the kinds of diseases that send us in the global north into a tailspin. So, I mean, if you look, for example, at our gut microbiomes, the most denuded microbiomes on Earth are city dwellers in the global north. And compare that, say, with Yanomami communities in the Amazon, whose microbiomes have species of bacteria that are extinct in us. a recent report noticed that you know, levels and markers of inflammation were way lower in those communities. Even though infectious diseases were coming in and out of individual bodies, people were much better able to fight them off, right? And in fact, I should correct myself. This language of fighting off is something that I default to and shouldn't. I was using it the other day. I was like, oh, you know, I'm feeling a bit under the weather. I'm fighting something off. And that's not right. You're not fighting something off. You're learning to live with something. Mm. And that idea of better being able to live with things is bolstered when you have more things to live with, right? When we have a much richer and much more diverse ecology within us and around us, that's a better way of living with things. Now, unfortunately, the response from the medical industry and the pharmaceutical industry in the global north is, aha, these indigenous people have an incredible poop. We need basically the combination of Indiana Jones and Elon Musk to rescue that poop, turn it into a pill, and allow us to inoculate ourselves. And that's balmy for a number of reasons. Obviously, you know, just sort of trading in indigenous shit while allowing these indigenous communities to die, right? Yanomami communities on the front line of gold and mercury poisoning, gold mining and mercury poisoning in the Amazon under Bolsonaro. And you know, the Amazon is up in flames because of what we're doing. And so rather than save the relationships and the ecologies around indigenous communities, we're like, no, we're going to salvage their poop while they're still alive, bring it back to the global north, inoculate ourselves and see what happens. And you know what's going to happen is those microbes will die because they don't have the ecology in which to thrive. They only thrive as part of a teeming ecology outside your body as well as inside. So that's what we're discovering, that you know, the broken medical individualized approach that you're talking about, Andrew, is part of the problem for why things are dying, but it's also why stealing from indigenous people again is not going to work here when we think about microbiomes and reducing inflammation, because the inflammatory reduction comes not just from an individual microbe, but from a web of relations. So that's the big takeaway from the idea of inflame.
And it's also this failure to see that the toxins are so strong and powerful in our current system here in the global north that they wouldn't have a chance here.
That's right. And because we've eliminated the things that might be able to mediate and in some way sort of manage, help us manage and live with those toxins. Again, those microbes don't have a chance. You're right. Exactly right.
In preparing to speak to you today, what I kept thinking about was what your experience in finishing this book through the COVID pandemic was, not that it's over, but specifically in lockdown. You know, what were you seeing as the most critical systemic health problems throughout? I mean, because it's a myriad, right? But what did COVID kind of make visible for you specifically as you were working on this book?
It made visible how disposable some bodies were, right? You know, I live here in occupied Texas. I live in Austin. And look at where the greatest sort of bursts of COVID were. They were in prisons and slaughterhouses. And look at whose bodies were considered the most disposable in those circumstances. It was working people, people of color, and disproportionately women in overrepresented in the slaughterhouse working population. So, you know, it's exactly everyone who was in the front lines of colonialism and capitalism, the peoples who we were celebrating very briefly, but we were celebrating frontline workers and we were thankful and grateful. And it was important that for a moment, the working class in America was recognized. But it was also, it just became so aggravatingly clear that there was very little that stood in the way between the working class and the scourge of COVID. And in fact, the working class were sent as a layer of insulation so the middle class, the rest of us, could enjoy our meat undisturbed. And, you know, the meat industry successfully lobbied to be labeled as an essential business, even while EMT remains not an essential business, right? EMT workers are not essential under the federal government, but meat packing facilities were. Now, that should tell you everything you need to know about the disposability of certain bodies and in the front line. And that's what was so frustrating about this. You know, we were writing this book imagining that by the end of it, you know, we finished the last of it in the middle of the second wave. And we were like, okay, fine, everyone's going to get vaccinated. Even those people who are kind of hesitant about it, they will get over their shit. And it turns out that they won't. And there are some bad reasons and some mere reasons why some people aren't vaccinated. I mean, certainly for communities of people of color and low-income communities, if there are no opportunities and if there are lots of reasons to think that white men with, you know, strange vials of things that want to inject you may not have your best interests at heart, there are lots of histories in the United States about the ways that the medical industry has been predatory on communities of people of color. I mean, you know, we tell the story not just of the Tuskegee experiments, but also of the prison experiments that happened where many of the cosmetics that we use today depended on, quote, acres of skin, was the term that a medic talked about finding in prisons. Some really horrific prison experiments are behind the most successful cosmetics that we use today. So, you know, there are some reasons why some communities have good reasons to be suspicious of vaccination. But then we've got our crazy relatives whose understanding of the world is rendered more toxic by the flows of information and knowledge and stories that they get through these for-profit networks like Facebook, for example, or Fox or whatever it is. And you know, that's the other thing that was frustrating here. What we're trying to do and trying to highlight in the book is how stories can be protective. When you have certain kinds of stories, like Indigenous communities in Canada, when they're able to tell stories in their own languages, are, other things being equal, better protected from diabetes than other communities. So having the right stories can really protect you from disease. Mm. But you know, what's been frustrating in this moment is to recognize quite how dangerous the wrong kinds of stories are.
Yeah, I mean, there's a war of epistemics. Mm-hmm. Back to the medical education system, and you speak a lot about deep medicine. What do you think needs to change, or what do you think is even possible to change within the medical education system to impact health outcomes in a positive way?
You know, Rupert and I take our lead not just from the many young students who are mounting a campaign of decolonizing medicine, you know, that we've seen decolonizing the curriculum in other areas, economics, English, what have you. But decolonizing medicine is a thing. And luckily, there was someone who is quite a pioneer here, the French Algerian liberation scholar and psychiatrist, Frantz Fanon. Fanon, before he became, you know, this icon of liberation struggle and thinking, was a practicing psychiatrist in Algeria. And when he started running his ward, he noticed that, for example, the white women that he was in charge of were just being locked away and sequestered. And instead, he tried to change the architecture of the psychiatric ward. And so he bust everything open. He had set up a printing press and a cinema so that those women were able to actually engage in media production and watch movies. And all of a sudden, yeah, they got better. For the Algerian men that he was working with, though, that didn't work. What worked for them was, you know, football. In the end, a lot of the therapy was getting out away from the hospital and into the football field. Now, those moments of decolonizing medicine for him were, you know, really architectural, but they were also, as you say, epistemic. I love that idea, Andrew, that there is a sort of epistemic war going on. But in the end, he had to walk away from medicine because, you know, one of his lines was that the doctor also owns the land. And ownership of land was a problem in a colonial country. And, you know, we live in a colonized country here. It's awkward to remember that from time to time, but we do. And taking a relationship to that means busting open ways of understanding the ground beneath our feet and our relationship, you know, to food and medicine. You know, this is another big idea in the book that, let me take a step back and ask you, how do you know that you are taking medicine? Well, you know, the reason you know you're taking medicine is that someone in a white coat has told you this is medicine. There is a story. There is a narrative. There are, you know, FDA licenses. There are stickers and labels that we are attuned to. But most human civilizations don't draw a line between food and medicine. Ours is really the only one that does that. Mm. Why? Well, there's a for-profit reason, and there are, again, long epistemic histories of who can think and who can feel and whose knowledge is valuable. And what we're excited about is taking the best of science, of peer review, of the sort of cutting-edge technologies that we celebrate and write about in the book, but to decolonize them by introducing other peers into the peer review process. People who have been left out of, you know, systematically excluded. And that usually means putting patients first. So if we're thinking about medicine, you know, it's usually about 20 seconds into a patient-doctor discussion before the doctor interrupts the patient. And what would it be like to have the patient talk for much, much longer and to be a peer in their, you know, in their healing process rather than a subject of it? So those are the kinds of ideas that we see bubbling up. And, you know, Rupert has founded an organization called the Deep Medicine Circle that's about rematriating land and about bringing food and medicine together on different lands. I'm a part of that organization. I'm very proud to be. And I think that's one of the examples of how you see a lot of this stuff happening. So, you know, we're one example, but there are thousands of these things happening across what is now the United States and around the world. Hmm.
And you speak a bit about some of this historical scholarship that you were applying to this book. You also were looking at Foucault and Marxism. Hmm. Specifically with Foucault, what were you most interested in terms of the writings he's done about relation to power and things like this?
Foucault has so much to offer people who are interested in bodies, in the way that the bodies are held and made and constrained and individualized. But one of the things that we were excited about was he has a book called The Birth of the Clinic. And listeners may know that Foucault is very interested in the buildings and institutions that liberalism has created. So prisons, schools, hospitals, clinics, and even, you know, the private bedroom in his History of Sexuality is also an investigation into certain kinds of space. He is, in one reading, a geographer, and he's very interested in the geography of the body. And so we use some of his work tracking, for example, the 18th century physician Broussais, who was the first person who said, look, actually, you can track into your body where fevers happen. And that's, you know, one of the reasons why, you know, if you have an itis, you have an inflammation of whatever it is, itis, so tonsillitis, appendicitis. Mm-hmm. So you know, there are locations where bad health is happening. Now, that idea of look here to see what's going wrong is a really interesting one. It's a great advance in modern medicine from rather than look at the miasmas or, you know, let's check whether you're phlegmatic or not, which was the sort of 17th century idea. The 19th century ideas were much more located in the body. What we're doing in the 21st century is looking way outside the body. I mean, yes, the body is the site of where things have gone horribly wrong, but the chemicals didn't start here. Mm. The insults didn't begin here. The denuding of our microbiome, the absence is here, but the causes are way outside. And so we're using Foucault's idea of looking at the geography of disease and blasting it open with the best science we have in the early 21st century.
In your 2018 book, A History of the World in Seven Cheap Things, you focus on nature, money, work, care, food, energy, and lives as the seven things that have made our world and kind of shape our future. Mm. First, how do you define cheap? And second, how has COVID shifted your thinking around these areas? And particularly, I'm interested in our relationship with nature.
In thinking about cheap things, what we were pointing to is that capitalism is a system that doesn't pay its bills. And if there is a way for businesses to shift the costs onto someone else, they will do that. And most of all, that comes in the way that our society as a whole is encouraged to think about nature. Again, this is something that's very unique to our brand of colonial capitalism. Other civilizations don't see a hard line between humans and everything else in the world. This is something that's very unique to our particular civilization, and it's odd. But it does permit us to do certain things. First of all, people who we think are subhuman, we can treat very differently. We can treat them like animals, and we can treat animals like plants. We treat plants like soil or mountains or whatever it is. We can pick them up and dispose of them as we see fit. And that's why we called it, not just then, but not just when the book came out, but in previous work, that a pandemic was in the offing because of the way that we treat nature. If you treat nature as this thing that you can experiment with, you know, it's an infinite resource and an infinite trash can, then you're okay with encroaching on forests so that the rates of zoonotic disease transmission go up. You're okay with creating concentrated animal feeding operations that in 2007 spawned the H1N1 outbreak and which have generated a range of other diseases like Nipah virus and hepatitis E. Mm. The way that humans treat nature as cheap, as disposable, as something we don't have to pay for, that we'll, you know, we can use without consequence, is something that, as we said in The History of the World and Seven Cheap Things, is definitely going to have consequences. And COVID, it seems to me, while the debate is still raging about whether it was a lab escape or a zoonotic transmission, either way, what it demonstrates is that people felt okay with either smooshing different species right next to each other or futzing with nature without consequence. And that's obviously something where we have lost our humility in the face of the web of life. Mm. And absent that awe, and instead seeing only the profit motive or the mere will to power, the possibility of domination, bad things will happen. So, you know, COVID unfortunately reconfirmed and sort of proved our hypothesis here that, again, in the history of the world in Seven Cheap Things, we try and break it down by talking about the most capitalist object there is, which is the chicken nugget. And we use the chicken nugget as an example of, you know, capitalism gone wild because, the most popular bird today is the chicken. If there is, you know, a species after ours that's able to do archaeology, they will find plastic in the sea, they will find radiation from our nuclear weapons tests, and they will find trillions of chicken bones because that's what humans have done to the planet. And the nugget is an example not only of the way that we engineer this red jungle fowl into this beast of a bird, but then, you know, the labor and the exposures of people in slaughterhouses and the low wages and a range of things that, since we wrote about that, have epitomized how it is that working people have suffered under COVID. So unfortunately, I was right and I didn't want to be.
Yeah. I mean, it's even that in that word nugget, which goes back to gold nuggets, to mining. I've never thought about the link between chickens and mining, but it's kind of fascinating.
Yeah, no, it is. It's an extraction.
Your 2012 book, Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World Food System, goes into international social movements working to create more sustainable and democratic food systems. And I'm wondering, after the past year and a half of COVID-19, do you still have hope for these systems? Do you think that there are positive impacts on our food systems due to COVID, or is it quite bleak?
I'm so glad you asked that, Spencer, because normally people are like, yeah, no, we're fucked. One of the things that has always been true about the food system that is that while it has been increasingly dominated by large monopolies, and that tendency towards monopoly has only gotten worse since Stuffed and Starved came out, it's also the case that more and more farmers are wise to things like climate change and find themselves having to navigate climate change because the governments are not doing anything. I was very heartened to read a study that showed that 8 million farmer groups, so not just 8 million farmers, 8 million groups of farmers around the world are experimenting with new climate change resilient food system production techniques, ideas of agroecology that we began today's discussion with. And it's also been really heartening to see when governments have failed, like in Mexico, there's been a fairly shoddy response to the pandemic. And so peasant groups have been sending food to the cities. In Colombia, big protests against the government have resulted in students as their number one demand asking for food sovereignty. Protests around hunger in South Africa have been modulated by the idea that food must be for everyone. So yes, this is a very dark time, and the number of hungry people who are food insecure is now well over 2 billion. 2 billion people. So again, one in three people on Earth is food insecure. And at the same time, you're seeing organizing happening, you know, despite the state and despite the private sector, from social movements who are caring for one another. You know, the bigger idea in Inflamed is we need a revolution of care. But the big thing happening on the ground is that movements are emerging to care for one another. I mean, even here in Austin, when we had our big freeze, I don't know if y'all caught that on the media, but we were in February without electricity and water for a good while. And what happened was that the organizations here that had already been helping people through COVID kind of stepped up and made sure that we had an alternative food distribution network to make sure that people without electricity or water like us were able to get some warmth and to be able to get some food and be able to get some water that wasn't frozen. You know, it is possible for people to organize despite the worst of this. And I think that's exciting to see.
You're hopeful in people, not so much in corporations. The problem is they're sort of labeled as people and have the rights of people. And so there's this core fundamental issue about how we view corporations and the power that we give them.
Yeah. It was very disturbing to read that for many people, their employer is trusted more than the government. And I get it, but, you know, particularly now that we're in this very dark moment of American democracy, faith in government institutions is at an all-time low. But it's not necessarily the case that your employer is your friend. The idea that we are going to find our way out of this mess led by people who want to get off this planet, Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos and Richard Branson, bless them. You know, it's not entirely clear to me that we have our faith in the right institutions. But that's because, this gets back to our earlier ideas around individualism. We've lost our faith in ourselves. We've lost our faith in our capacity to do things as a community because we feel so routinely powerless when we try to affect change as individuals, as we are schooled to do. And that's not how change has ever happened. It's not that, apartheid was ended by people shopping differently, or that the civil rights movement was won by the right kind of attentiveness at farmers markets. Social change happens when we do things socially. And it's tragic that corporations are what seems to have replaced our understanding and possibility of social movements. And again, if there's a silver lining here, it is that we are in a moment where people are unionizing and gathering together in much more sort of systematic and widespread ways.
Mm. One movement you've done work with in the food realm is Via Campesina. And I'm wondering if you could share what that organization does and also what you've learned with working with them.
So for folk who don't know, the international peasant movement, La Via Campesina, the peasant way, is an organization of now over 200 million farmers, farm workers, and folk involved in the food system. In the United States, the National Family Farm Coalition and the Border Worker Coalition are part of La Via Campesina. So, it's a broad organization from farmers to the people that farmers employ. But what they've really been interested in is bringing the possibilities of change back onto the agenda. So they have been at the forefront of developing ideas around agroecology. Again, the sort of systemic way of thinking, not just about food on the ground, but food in the fields, but also how that food circulates, how the work to make that food is divided, and how we as a society have conversations that bring us together to make sure that nobody goes hungry. So what this means is that actually one of the big policies that La Via Campesina is calling for is an idea called food sovereignty. And food sovereignty just means communities need to be able to get together and decide what their food policy is. And that sounds very, benign. It just means people need a right to have rights over their food system. But in order for that to happen, we need functioning democracies. And in order for that to happen, we need an end to gender inequality, because often the food system depends on the exploitation of particularly of women's work. That this idea of food sovereignty, the bumper sticker, isn't it? Food sovereignty is about an end to all forms of violence against women. And this isn't just a call for an end to domestic violence, but a call for an end to the exploitation of women's work. Now, this is an odd thing for a group of peasants to develop if you hold on to the idea that peasants are irredeemably backward and stuck in a different century. But there are peasants, and there are quite a lot of them, and they have some vanguard science and analysis around why hunger exists and what we can do to end it. And all the data that I'm seeing, and I've been looking at a range of scientific findings from soil chemistry to anthropometrics of how people's bodies do under agroecology and agroecological systems. And it turns out that if we want to eat in the 21st century, we need to shift to the kinds of agriculture and agricultural systems that La Via Campesina is calling for. And the members of Via Campesina are precisely these organizations that are sending food to the cities, that are training people in ways of farming that doesn't exploit the planet, but in fact builds the biodiversity that we need for our internal biomes, but for our external ones as well. Mm. So I've been following them for a while, and I've been schooled and I've been humbled by the things that they know that I don't even think to ask about, whether it is about these sort of frontline ideas of gender equality or the experiments that they're conducting to be able to make sure that we men come to terms with our patriarchy. We didn't ask to be born in a patriarchal society, but we have been, and we've reaped the rewards of that. And the interesting question for us is, all right, what practices of liberation can we adopt to end that exploitation and end our participation in something that, again, we all recognize that we don't want to be more sexist than we are. We want to be less sexist. But how do we do that in a way that feels like liberation and not like, oh God, I've got to do the right thing, but in fact, being better people? And La Via Campesina has shown me how it is that's possible. And that's to be schooled by peasants is something that we should all be lucky enough to experience.
Mm.
When you envision kind of a future of greater planetary human health now, after you've made your book and this moment in time, are you hopeful that the generation coming up now that has a front row seat for this and is sort of watching this slow train crash is going to create a new version of capitalism, global connection? Or do you think that they are going to figure out something entirely different? What do you think is actually possible from a kind of rationally optimistic perspective about the generation coming up?
Well, I mean, I think pessimism of the intellect and optimism of the will is the right way to go, isn't it? Because, you know, it's not like you don't have your new kind of slice of Tucker Carlson wannabes. And yeah, I mean, living in Texas, you can see a sort of young and entitled vanguard brought up with more money than sense, who are quite happy for the current order to prevail and quite happy to ride it all the way down as long as they're on top. And at the same time, my students, Rupert's students, are very interested in what comes next because this is so obviously broken. And I think there's everything to play for. I certainly think that, you know, the younger generation is thinking about things with a clarity that I think was harder for us because it didn't seem like there was an alternative. You know, with the fall of the Soviet Union, you know, no matter what you thought of it, there was only one show in town. It was America, and that's what happened. And now with this country so obviously broken and with lots of different other ideas that were always beneath the surface kind of bubbling up, you know, different kinds of indigenous economy, different kinds of ways of exchanging that involve free markets, freer than under capitalism, but don't, you know, do away with the idea of money or exchange. I think that those kinds of ideas are very exciting, but you know, they're not going to come from Silicon Valley. They are going to come from practices that happen on the ground, you know, in the interstices of moments of crisis. But that's okay. You know, I mean, I just finished a film that took 10 years to film, where we were following some peasants in Malawi and how they ended patriarchy. And ending patriarchy in an African village and thereby ending hunger doesn't seem like the sort of thing that's possible if you only believe that Bob Geldof or, you know, whoever it is, you know, is capable of saving Africa. But the fact is, there are these big picture solutions happening. And when those activists wanted to come to America to persuade us to be sufficiently equally ambitious, they found some farmers thought, oh my God, no, we couldn't possibly do that. And others were absolutely saying, yes, you know, we've been on the front lines of poverty. We know what it means to be exploited. We know that we have to build ways of farming that allow people to live and earn a decent income and allow the planet to survive. And here's an example. And so insofar as there is a proliferation of alternatives and a seasoned fight against, you know, the ruling class, I think there's reason for hope.
Broadly speaking, or big picture, whole earth, what is your greatest hope as we emerge from the pandemic, whenever we emerge from it?
I think the greatest hope lies in connection and care. I mean, certainly the pandemic, no one would have wished it on any of us. I've lost family. I would be shocked if y'all hadn't also come across loss in one way or another. This has been an awful time. And what this has taught us is how valuable it is to be cared for and to do caring, to be a carer, right? Mm. That is not something that it's impossible to forget. You know, it's always worth remembering how short our memories can be. But the experience of caring and of reprioritizing our lives so that we can care and be loved is, I think, kind of wonderful. It's the silver lining here. I mean, obviously the cloud is dark, but the ways that communities have come together to care for one another, I think has been tremendously important and instructive. And one of the solutions that we offer at the end of Inflamed is the idea of a care revolution. You know, care is a very low carbon thing. It's a very low energy thing. It's a very sustainable thing. If you're caring for other beings in the web of life, whether it's, you know, your family or your community or the soil beneath your feet, it's a way of building that offers not just immediate rewards in terms of your body, in terms of reducing inflammation. Caring is very anti-inflammatory. Singing along in a choir, being part of a community, it's all very anti-inflammatory. It's good for you. Building these connections is one of the things that cities are shit at, right? You know, we live in these cities with more people in smaller places than any time in human history, and we're lonelier than we've ever been. But caring for one another is a way of breaking out of that. And those instincts and experiences of care are ones that I think we can use as a kind of rocket fuel as we go forward. You know, there's a long way to go, but I do think that that might be a way that we can all take our experiences of loss and of grief, which are real. The grief of a dying planet is something that we're going to have to live with in a chronic way. But we can take that and do something much better with it than we've been allowed to so far.
And caring, of course, is something that AI cannot do.
Indeed. Yeah, I'm not looking forward to that day.
Raj, this has been great. Thank you so much for coming on.
Spencer and Andrew, thank you. Really appreciate you.
Thanks for listening. To hear more episodes of At a Distance, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or Stitcher. You can follow us on Instagram at slowdown.tv. To sign up for our weekly newsletter exploring the five senses, head to our website at www.slowdown.tv.